All around the restaurant, people and things relaxed and chatted. The air was filled with talk of this and that, and with the mingled scents of exotic plants, extravagant foods, and insidious wines. For an infinite number of miles in every direction, the universal cataclysm was gathering to a stupefying climax. Glancing at his watch, Max returned to the stage with a flourish. "And now, ladies and gentlemen," he beamed, "is everyone having one last wonderful time?" "Yes," called out the sort of people who called out yes when comedians ask them if they're having a wonderful time. "That's wonderful," enthused Max. "Absolutely wonderful. And as the photon storms gather in swirling crowds around us, preparing to tear apart the last of the red-hot suns, I know you're all going to want to settle back and enjoy with me what I know we will all find an immensely exciting and terminal experience." He paused. He caught the audience with a glittering eye. "Believe me, ladies and gentlemen," he said, "there is nothing penultimate about this one." He paused again. Tonight his timing was immaculate. Time after time he'd done the show, night after night. Not that the word night had any meaning here at the extremity of time. All there was the endless repetition of the final moment as the restaurant rocked slowly forward over the brink of time's furthest edge. And back again. This night was good, though. The audience was writhing in the palm of his sickly hand. His voice dropped. They had to strain to hear him. "This," he said, "really is the absolute end, the final chilling desolation in which the whole majestic sweep of creation becomes extinct. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the proverbial it." He dropped his voice to lower. In the stillness, a fly would not have dared clear its throat. "After this," he said, "there is nothing. Void, emptiness, oblivion, absolute nothing." His eyes glittered again, or did they twinkle? "Nothing. Except, of course, for the sweet trolley and a fine selection of Aldebaran liqueurs." The band gave him a musical sting. He wished they wouldn't. He didn't need it. Not an artist of his caliber. He could play the audience like his own musical instrument. They were laughing with relief. He followed on. "And for once," he cried cheerily, "you don't have to worry about having a hangover in the morning, because there won't be any more mornings." He beamed at his happy, laughing audience. He glanced up at the sky, going through the same death routine every night. But his glance was only for a fraction of a second. He trusted it to do its job, as one professional trusts another. "And now," he said, strutting about the stage, "at the risk of putting a damper on the wonderful sense of doom and futility here this evening, I would like to welcome a few parties." He pulled a card from his pocket. "Do we have," he put up a hand to hold back the cheers, "do we have a party here from the Zansel Quasia Flammarion Bridge Club from beyond the Vought Void of Kwan? Are they here?" A routine cheer came from the back, but he pretended not to hear. He peered around, trying to find them. "Are they here?" he asked again, to elicit a louder cheer. He got it, as he always did. "Ah, there they are. Well, last bids, lads, and no cheating. Remember, this is a very solemn moment." He lapped up the laughter. "And do we have a party of minor deities from the halls of Asgard?" Away to his right came a rumble of thunder. Lightning arced across the stage. A small group of hairy men with helmets sat looking very pleased at themselves and raised their glasses to him. "Has-beens," he thought to himself. "Careful with that hammer, sir," he said. They did their trick with the lightning again. Max gave them a very thin-lipped smile. "And thirdly," he said, "thirdly, a party of young conservatives from Sirius B. Are they here?" A party of smartly dressed young dogs stopped throwing rolls at each other and started throwing rolls at the stage. They yapped and barked unintelligibly. "Yes," said Maxwell, "this is all your fault, you realize that?" "And finally," said Max, quietening the audience down and putting on his solemn face, "finally, I believe we have with us here tonight a party of believers, very devout believers, from the Church of the Second Coming of the Great Prophet Zarquan." There were about 20 of them, sitting right out on the edge of the floor, ascetically dressed, sipping mineral water nervously and staying apart from the festivities. They blinked resentfully as the spotlight was turned on them. "There they are," said Max, "sitting there patiently. He said he'd come again and he's kept you waiting a long time, so let's hope he's hurrying, fellas, because he's only got 8 minutes left." The party of Zarquan's followers sat rigid, refusing to be buffeted by the waves of uncharitable laughter which swept over them. Max restrained his audience. No, but seriously though, folks, seriously though, no offence meant. No, I know we shouldn't make fun of deeply held beliefs, so I think a big hand, please, for the great Prophet Zarquan. The audience clapped respectfully. Wherever he's got to! He blew a kiss to the stony-faced party and returned to the centre of the stage. He grabbed a tall stool and sat on it. It's marvellous, though, he rattled on, to see so many of you here tonight. No, isn't it, though? Yes, absolutely marvellous, because I know that so many of you come here time and time again, which I think is really wonderful, to come and watch this final end of everything and then return home to your own eras and raise families, strive for new and better societies, fight terrible wars for what you know to be right. It really gives one hope for the future of all life kind. Except, of course, he waved at the blitzing turmoil above and around them, that we know it hasn't got one! Arthur turned to Ford. He hadn't quite got this place worked out in his mind. Look, surely, he said, if the universe is about to end, don't we go with it? Ford gave him a three-pan-galactic gargle blaster look. In other words, a rather unsteady one. No, he said. Look, he said, as soon as you come into this dive, you get held in a sort of amazing force-shielded temporal warp thing, I think. Oh, said Arthur. He turned his attention back to a bowl of soup he'd managed to get from the waiter to replace his steak. Look, said Ford, I'll show you. He grabbed at a napkin off the table and fumbled hopelessly with it. Look, he said. Imagine this napkin, right, as the temporal universe, right? And the spoon as a transductional mode in the matter curve. It took him a while to say this last part, and Arthur hated to interrupt him. That's the spoon I was eating with, he said. Right, said Ford. Imagine this spoon. He found a small wooden spoon on a tray of relishes. This spoon, but found it rather tricky to pick up. No, better still, this fork. Hey, would you let go of my fork? Snapped Zaphod. All right, said Ford. All right. Why don't we say that this wine glass is the temporal universe? What, the one you just knocked on the floor? Did I do that? Yes. All right, said Ford. Forget that. I mean, look, do you know how the universe actually began, for a kickoff? Probably not, said Arthur, who wished he'd never embarked on any of this. All right, said Ford. Imagine this. Right, you get this bath. Right, large, round bath. And it's made of ebony. Where from, said Arthur. Harrods was destroyed by the Vogons. Doesn't matter. Well, so you keep saying. Listen. All right. You get this bath. See? Imagine you've got this bath, and it's ebony. And it's conical. Conical, said Arthur. What's the... Shh, said Ford. It's conical. So what you do is, you see, you fill it with fine white sand. All right? Or sugar. Fine white sand and or sugar. Anything. Doesn't matter. Sugar's fine. And when it's full, you pull the plug out. Are you listening? I'm listening. You pull the plug out, and it all just twirls away. It twirls away, you see, out of the plug hole. I see. You don't see. You don't see at all. I haven't got the clever bit yet. You want to hear the clever bit? Tell me the clever bit. I'll tell you the clever bit. Ford thought for a moment, trying to remember what the clever bit was. The clever bit, he said, is this. You film it happening. Clever, agreed Arthur. You get a movie camera and you film it happening. Clever. That's not the clever bit. This is the clever bit. I remember now that this is the clever bit. The clever bit is that you then thread the film and the projector backwards. Backwards? Yes, threading it backwards is definitely the clever bit. So then you just sit and watch it, and everything just appears to spiral upwards out of the plug hole and fill the bath. See? And that's how the universe began, is it? Said Arthur. No, said Ford, but it's a marvellous way to relax. He reached for his wine glass. Where's my wine glass? He said. It's on the floor. Ah. Tipping back his chair to look for it, Ford collided with the small green waiter who was approaching the table, carrying a portable telephone. Ford excused himself to the waiter, explaining that it was because he was extremely drunk. The waiter said that was quite all right and that he perfectly understood. Ford thanked the waiter for his kind indulgence, attempted to tug his forelock, missed by 6 inches, and slid under the table. Mr. Zaphod Beeblebrox, inquired the waiter. Yeah, said Zaphod, glancing up from his third steak. There is a phone call for you.
Hey, what?
A phone call, sir.
For me? Here? Hey, but I mean, who knows where I am?
One of his minds raced, the other dawdled lovingly over the food it was still shoveling in. Excuse me if I carry on, won't you? Said his eating head and carried on. There were now so many people after him, he'd lost count. He shouldn't have made such a conspicuous entrance. Hell, why not, though, he thought. How do you know you're having fun if there's no one watching you have it?
Maybe somebody tipped off the Galactic Police, said Trillian. Everyone saw you come in.
You mean they want to arrest me over the phone? Said Zaphod.
Could be. I'm a pretty dangerous dude when I'm cornered.
Yeah, said a voice from under the table. You go to pieces so fast, people get hit by the shrapnel.
Hey, what is this, Judgment Day? Snapped Zaphod.
Do we get to see that as well? Asked Arthur nervously.
I'm in no hurry, muttered Zaphod.
Okay, so who's the cat on the phone? He kicked forward. Hey, get up there, kid, he said to him. I may need you.
I am not, said the waiter, personally acquainted with the metal gentleman in question, sir.
Metal?
Yes, sir.
Did you say metal?
Yes, sir. I said that I am not personally acquainted with the metal gentleman in question.
Okay, carry on.
But I am informed that he has been awaiting your return for a considerable number of millennia. It seems that you left here somewhat precipitately.
Left here? Said Zaphod. Are you being strange? We only just arrived here.
Indeed, sir, persisted the waiter doggedly. But before you arrived here, sir, I understand that you left here. Zaphod tried this in one brain and then in the other.
You're saying, he said, that before we arrived here, we left here?
This is going to be a long night, thought the waiter. Precisely, sir, he said.
Put your analysts on danger money, baby, advised Zaphod.
No, wait a minute, said Ford, emerging above table level again. Where exactly is here?
But to be absolutely exact, sir, it is the Frogstar World B.
But we just left there, protested Zaphod. We left there and came to the restaurant at the end of the universe.
Yes, sir, said the waiter, feeling that he was now into the home stretch and running well. The one was constructed on the ruins of the other.
Oh, said Arthur brightly. You mean we've travelled in time, but not in space? Listen, you semi of old simian, cut in Zaphod. Go climb a tree, will you?
Arthur bristled. Go bang your heads together, four eyes, he advised Zaphod.
No, no, the waiter said to Zaphod. Your monkey has got it right, sir.
Arthur stuttered in fury and said nothing apposite or indeed coherent.
You jumped forward, I believe, 576,000,000,000 years, while staying in exactly the same place, explained the waiter. He smiled. He had a wonderful feeling that he'd finally won through against what seemed to be insuperable odds.
That's it, said Zaphod. I got it. I told the computer to send us to the nearest place to eat. That's exactly what it did. Give or take 576,000,000,000 years or whatever, we never moved. Neat.
They all agreed that this was very neat.
But who, said Zaphod, is the cat on the phone?
Whatever happened to Marvin, said Trillian.
Zaphod clapped his hands to his head.
The paranoid android! I left him moping about on Frogstar B!
When was this?
Well, 576,000,000,000 years ago, I suppose, said Zaphod. Hey, hand me the rat rod plate, Captain.
The little waiter's eyebrows wandered about his forehead in confusion.
I beg your pardon, sir? The phone, waiter, said Zaphod, grabbing it off him. Shee, you guys are so unhip, it's a wonder your bums don't fall off.
Indeed, sir.
Hey, Marvin, is that you? Said Zaphod into the phone. How you doing, kid?
There was a long pause before a thin, low voice came up the line.
I think you ought to know I'm feeling very depressed, it said.
Zaphod cupped his hand over the phone.
It's Marvin, he said. Hey, Marvin, he said into the phone again. We're having a great time. Food, wine, a little personal abuse, and the universe going foom. Where can we find you?
Again the pause.
You don't have to pretend to be interested in me, you know,
said Marvin at last.
I know perfectly well I'm only a menial robot.
Okay, okay, said Zaphod, but where are you?
Reverse primary thrust, Marvin. That's what they say to me. Open airlock number 3, Marvin. Marvin, can you pick up that piece of paper? Can I pick up that piece of paper? Here I am, brain the size of a planet, and they ask me to...
Yeah, yeah,
sympathized Zaphod hardly at all.
but I'm quite used to being humiliated,"
droned Marvin.
"I can even go and stick my head in a bucket of water, if you like. Would you like me to go and stick my head in a bucket of water? I've got one ready. Wait a minute."
Hey, Marvin,"
interrupted Zaphod, but it was too late. Sad little clunks and gurgles came up the line. "What's he saying?" asked Trillian.
Nothing," said Zaphod. "He just phoned up to wash his head at us."
"There,"
said Marvin, coming back on the line and bubbling a bit.
"I hope that gave satisfaction."
Yeah, said Zaphod. "Now, will you please tell us where you are?"
"I'm in the car park,"
said Marvin.
"The car park?" said Zaphod. "What are you doing there?"
"Parking cars. What else does one do in a car park?"
"Okay, hang in there. We'll be right down."
In one movement, Zaphod leapt to his feet, threw down the phone and wrote "Hot Black Desiato" on the bill.
"Come on, guys," he said. "Marvin's in the car park. Let's get on down."
"What's he doing in the car park?" said Arthur.
"Parking cars. What else, dum-dum?"
"But what about the end of the universe? We'll miss the big moment."
"I've seen it. It's rubbish," said Zaphod. "Nothing but a gnab gib."
"A what?" "Opposite of a big bang. Come on, let's get zappy." Few of the other diners paid them any attention as they weaved their way through the restaurant to the exit. Their eyes were riveted on the horror of the skies. "An interesting effect to watch for," Max was telling them, "is in the upper left-hand quadrant of the sky, where if you look very carefully, you'll see the star system Hastramel boiling away into the ultraviolet. Anyone here from Hastramel?"
There are one or two slightly hesitant cheers from somewhere at the back.
"Well," said Max, beaming cheerfully at them, "it's too late to worry about whether you left the gas on now."
Chapter 18. The main reception foyer was almost empty, but Ford nevertheless weaved his way through it. Zaphod grasped him firmly by the arm and manoeuvred him into a cubicle standing to one side of the entrance hall. "What are you doing to him?" asked Arthur.
Sobering him up," said Zaphod, and pushed a coin into a slot. Lights flashed, gases swirled.
"Hi," said Ford, stepping out a moment later. "Where are we going?"
"Down to the car park, come on."
"What about the personnel time teleport?" said Ford. "Get us straight back to the Heart of Gold."
"Yeah, but I've cooled on that ship. Zarniwip can have it. I don't want to play his games. Let's see what we can find."
A Sirius Cybernetics Corporation, happy vertical people transporter, took them down deep into the substrata beneath the restaurant. They were glad to see it had been vandalized and didn't try to make them happy as well as take them down. At the bottom of the shaft, the lift doors opened and a blast of cold, stale air hit them. The first thing they saw on leaving the lift was a long concrete wall with over 50 doors in it, offering lavatory facilities for all of 50 major life forms. Nevertheless, like every car park in the galaxy, throughout the entire history of car parks, this car park smelt predominantly of impatience. They turned a corner and found themselves on a moving catwalk that traversed a vast cavernous space that stretched off into the dim distance. It was divided off into bays, each of which contained a spaceship belonging to one of the diners upstairs, some smallish and utilitarian mass-production models, others vast shining limo ships, the playthings of the very rich. Zaphod's eyes sparkled with something that may or may not have been avarice as he passed over them. In fact, it's best to be clear on this point. Avarice is definitely what it was.
"There he is," said Trillian. "Marvin, down there."
They looked where she was pointing. Dimly they could see a small metal figure listlessly rubbing a small rag on one remote corner of a giant silver sun cruiser. At short intervals along the moving catwalk, wide transparent tubes led down to the floor level. Zaphod stepped off the catwalk into one of these and floated gently downwards. The others followed. Thinking back to this later, Arthur thought it was the single most enjoyable experience of his travels in the galaxy.
"Hey, Marvin," said Zaphod, striding over towards him. "Hey, kid, are we pleased to see you?"
Marvin turned, and insofar as it is possible for a totally inert metal face to look reproachful, this is what it did.
"No, you're not," he said. "No one ever is."
"Ah, suit yourself," said Zaphod, and turned away to ogle the ships.
Ford went with him. Only Trillian and Arthur actually went up to Marvin.
"No, really we are," said Trillian, and patted him in a way that he disliked intensely. "Hanging around waiting for us all this time."
576,003,579 years, said Marvin. "I counted them."
"Well, we're here now," said Trillian, feeling quite correctly in Marvin's view that it was a slightly foolish thing to say.
"The first 10 million years were the worst," said Marvin. "And the second 10 million, they were the worst too.
The third 10 million I didn't enjoy at all. After that, I went into a bit of a decline.
He paused just long enough to make them feel they ought to say something, and then interrupted.
It's the people you meet in this job that really get you down,
he said, and paused again. Trillian cleared her throat.
Is that...
The best conversation I had was over 40 million years ago,
continued Marvin. Again the pause.
Oh dear.
And that was with a coffee machine.
He waited.
Well, that's a...
You don't like talking to me, do you?
Said Marvin in a low, desolate tone. Trillian talked to Arthur instead. Further down the chamber, Fort Prefect had found something of which he very much liked the look. Several such things, in fact. Zaphod, he said in a quiet voice, just look at some of these little star trolleys. Zaphod looked and liked. The craft they were looking at was in fact pretty small, but extraordinary and very much a rich kid's toy. It was not much to look at. It resembled nothing so much as a paper dart about 20 feet long, made of thin but tough metal foil. At the rear end was a small horizontal 2-man cockpit. It had a tiny charm drive engine, which was not capable of moving it at any great speed. The thing it did have, however, was a heat sink. The heat sink had a mass of some 2,000 billion tons, and was contained within a black hole mounted in an electromagnetic field situated halfway along the length of the ship, and this heat sink enabled the craft to be manoeuvred within a few miles of a yellow sun, there to catch and ride the solar flares that burst out from its surface. Flare riding is one of the most exotic and exhilarating sports in existence, and those who can dare and afford to do it are amongst the most lionized men in the galaxy. It is also, of course, stupefyingly dangerous, and those who don't die riding invariably die of sexual exhaustion at one of the Daedalus Club's après flare parties. Ford and Zaphod looked and passed on. And this baby, said Ford, the tangerine star buggy with the black sunbusters. Again, the star buggy was a small ship, a totally misnamed one, in fact, because the one thing it couldn't manage was interstellar distances. Basically, it was a sporty planet hopper, dolled up to look like something it wasn't. Nice lines, though. They passed on. The next one was a big one and 30 yards long, a coach-built limo ship, and obviously designed with one aim in mind, that of making the beholder sick with envy. The paintwork and accessory detail clearly said, not only am I rich enough to afford this ship, I am also rich enough not to take it seriously. It was wonderfully hideous. Just look at it, said Zaphod. Multi-cluster quark drive, perspulex running boards, gotta be a Laszlo Lyricon custom job. He examined every inch. Yes, he said, look, the infra-pink lizard album on the neutrino cowling, Laszlo's trademark. The man has no shame. I was passed by one of these mothers once up by the Axial Nebula, said Ford. I was going flat out, and this thing just strolled past me, star drive hardly ticking over. Just incredible. Zaphod whistled appreciatively. 10 seconds later, said Ford, it smashed straight into the third moon of Jaglan Beta. Yeah, right? Amazing-looking ship, though. Looks like a fish, moves like a fish, steers like a cow. Ford looked around the other side. Hey, come see, he called out. There's a big mural painted on this side, a bursting sun. Disaster Area's trademark. This must be Hot Black's ship, lucky old bugger. They do this terrible song, you know, which ends with a stunt ship crashing into the sun. Meant to be an amazing spectacle. Expensive in stunt ships, though. Zaphod's attention, however, was elsewhere. His attention was riveted on the ship standing next to Hot Black Desiato's limo. His mouths hung open. That, he said, that is really bad for the eyes. Ford looked. He too stood astonished. It was a ship of classic, simple design, like a flattened salmon, 20 yards long, very clean, very sleek. There was just one remarkable thing about it. It's so black, said Ford Prefect. You can hardly make out its shape. Light just seems to fall into it. Zaphod said nothing. He had simply fallen in love. The blackness of it was so extreme that it was almost impossible to tell how close you were standing to it. Your eyes just slide off it, said Ford in wonder. It was an emotional moment. He bit his lip. Zaphod moved forward to it, slowly, like a man possessed, or more accurately, like a man who wanted to possess. His hand reached out to stroke it. His hand stopped. His hand reached out to stroke it again. His hand stopped again.
"Hey, come and feel the surface," he said in a hushed voice.
Ford put his hand out to feel it. His hand stopped.
You can't, he said.
See, said Zaphod,
it's just totally frictionless. This must be one mother of a mover.
He turned to look at Ford seriously. At least one of his heads did. The other stayed gazing in awe at the ship. What do you reckon, Ford? He said.
You mean,
Ford looked over his shoulder.
You mean, stroll off with it?
You think we should?
No.
No, nor do I.
But we're going to, aren't we?
How can we not? They gazed a little longer, till Zaphod suddenly pulled himself together.
We better shift soon, he said. In a moment or so the universe will have ended, and all the captain creeps will come pouring down here to find their bourgemobiles.
Zaphod, said Ford.
Yeah? How do we do it?
Ah, simple, said Zaphod. He turned.
Marvin,
he called. Slowly, laboriously, and with a million little clanking and creaking noises that he had learned to simulate, Marvin turned round to answer the summons.
Come on over here, said Zaphod. We've got a job for you.
Marvin trudged towards them.
I won't enjoy it, he said.
Yes, you will, enthused Zaphod. There's a whole new life stretching out ahead of you.
Oh, not another one, groaned Marvin.
Look, will you shut up and listen, hissed Zaphod. This time there's going to be excitement and adventure and really wild things.
Sounds awful.
Marvin, all I'm trying to ask you...
I suppose you want me to open the spaceship for you.
What? Yeah, that's right,
said Zaphod jumpily. He was keeping at least three eyes on the entrance. Time was short.
Well, I wish you'd just tell me rather than trying to engage my enthusiasm, said Marvin, because I haven't got one.
He walked on up to the ship, touched it, and a hatchway swung open. Ford and Zaphod stared at the opening.
Don't mention it, said Marvin. Oh, you didn't.
He trudged away again. Arthur and Trillian clustered round.
What's happening? Asked Arthur. Look at this, said Ford. Look at the interior of this ship.
Weirder and weirder, breathed Zaphod.
It's black, said Ford. Everything in it is just totally black.
In the restaurant, things were fast approaching the moment after which there wouldn't be any more moments. All eyes were fixed on the dome, other than those of Hot Black Desiato's bodyguard, which were looking intently at Hot Black Desiato, and those of Hot Black Desiato himself, which the bodyguard had closed out of respect. The bodyguard leaned forward over the table. Had Hot Black Desiato been alive, he would probably have deemed this a good moment to lean back or even go for a short walk. His bodyguard was not a man who improved with proximity. On account of his unfortunate condition, however, Hot Black Desiato remained totally inert.
Mr. Desiato, sir, whispered the bodyguard.
Whenever he spoke, it looked as if the muscles on either side of his mouth were clambering over each other to get out of the way.
Mr. Desiato, can you hear me?
Hot Black Desiato, quite naturally, said nothing.
Hot Black, hissed the bodyguard.
Again, quite naturally, Hot Black Desiato did not reply. Supernaturally, however, he did. On the table in front of him, a wine glass rattled, and a fork rose an inch or so and tapped against the glass. It settled on the table again. The bodyguard gave a satisfied grunt.
It's time we were going, Mr. Desiato,
muttered the bodyguard.
Don't want to get caught in the rush, not in your condition. You want to get to the next gig nice and relaxed. There was a really big audience for it, one of the best, Cacrophone, 576,002 million years ago. Had you will have been looking forward to it?
The fork rose again, paused, waggled in a non-committal sort of way, and dropped again.
Come on, said the bodyguard. It's going to have been great. You knocked them cold.
The bodyguard would have given Dr. Dan's street mentioner an apoplectic attack.
The black ship going into the sun always gets them, and the new one's a beauty. Be real sorry to see it go. If we get on down there, I'll set the black ship autopilot and we'll cruise off in the limo, okay?
The fork tapped once in agreement, and the glass of wine mysteriously emptied itself. The bodyguard wheeled Hot Black Desiato's chair out of the restaurant.
And now, cried Max from the centre of the stage, the moment you've all been waiting for!
He flung his arms into the air,
Behind him, the band went into a frenzy of percussion and rolling synth chords. Max had argued with them about this, but they claimed it was in their contract and that's what they would do. His agent would have to sort it out. "The skies begin to boil," he cried. "Nature collapses into the screaming void. In 20 seconds' time, the universe itself will be at an end. See where the light of infinity bursts in upon us." The hideous fury of destruction blazed about them, and at that moment a still, small trumpet sounded, as from an infinite distance. Max's eyes swiveled round to glare at the band. None of them seemed to be playing a trumpet. Suddenly, a wisp of smoke was swirling and shimmering on the stage next to him. The trumpet was joined by more trumpets. Over 500 times Max had done the show, and nothing like this had ever happened before. He drew back in alarm from the swirling smoke, and as he did so, a figure slowly materialized inside, the figure of an ancient man, bearded, robed, and wreathed in light. In his eyes were stars, and on his brow a golden crown. "What's this?" whispered Max, wild-eyed. "What's happening?" At the back of the restaurant, the stony-faced party from the Church of the Second Coming of the Great Prophet Zarquan leapt ecstatically to their feet, chanting and crying. Max blinked in amazement. He threw up his arms to the audience. "A big hand, please, ladies and gentlemen," he hollered, "for the great prophet Zarquan! He has come! Zarquan has come again!" Thunderous applause broke out as Max strode across the stage and handed his microphone to the prophet. Zarquan coughed. He peered round at the assembled gathering. The stars in his eyes twinkled uneasily. He handled the microphone with confusion. He said, "Hello? Look, I'm sorry I'm a bit late. I've had the most ghastly time, all sorts of things cropping up at the last moment. He seemed nervous with the expectant, awed hush. He cleared his throat. How are we for time?" he said. "Have I just got a..." And so the universe ended. Chapter 19. One of the major selling points of that wholly remarkable travel book, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, apart from its relative cheapness and the fact that it has the words "Don't Panic" written in large friendly letters on its cover, is its compendious and occasionally accurate glossary. The statistics relating to the geosocial nature of the universe, for instance, are deftly set out between pages 938,324 and 938,326. And the simplistic style in which they are written is partly explained by the fact that the editors, having to meet a publishing deadline, copied the information off the back of a packet of breakfast cereal, hastily embroidering it with a few footnotes, in order to avoid prosecution under the incomprehensibly tortuous galactic copyright laws. It is interesting to note that a later and wilier editor sent the book backwards in time through a temporal warp, and then successfully sued the breakfast cereal company for infringement of the same laws. Here is a sample. The universe. Some information to help you live in it. 1. Area. Infinite. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy offers this definition of the word infinite. Infinite. Bigger than the biggest thing ever and then some. Much bigger than that, in fact. Really amazingly immense. A totally stunning size. I mean, real, wow, that's big time. Infinity is just so big that by comparison, bigness itself looks really titchy. Gigantic multiplied by colossal multiplied by staggeringly huge is the sort of concept we're trying to get across here. 2. Imports. None. It is impossible to import things into an infinite area, there being no outside to import things in from. 3. Exports. None. See imports. 4. Population. None. It is known that there are an infinite number of worlds simply because there is an infinite amount of space for them to be in. However, not every one of them is inhabited. Therefore, there must be a finite number of inhabited worlds. Any finite number divided by infinity is as near to nothing as makes no odds. So the average population of all the planets in the universe can be said to be zero. From this it follows that the population of the whole universe is also zero, and any people you may meet from time to time are merely the products of a deranged imagination. 5. Monetary units. None. In fact, there are 3 freely convertible currencies in the galaxy, but none of them count. The Altarian dollar has recently collapsed, the Flanian Pobblebead is only exchangeable for other Flanian Pobblebeads, and the Triganic Pew has its own very special problems. Its exchange rate of 8 ningis to 1 pew is simple enough, but since a ningi is a triangular rubber coin 6,800 miles along each side, no one has ever collected enough to own 1 pew. Ningis are not negotiable currency, because the galactic banks refuse to deal in fiddling small change. From this basic premise, it is simple to prove that the galactic banks are also the product of a deranged imagination. 6. Art. None. The function of art is to hold the mirror up to nature, and there simply isn't a mirror big enough. See point 1. 7. Sex. None. Well, in fact, there is an awful lot of this, largely because of the total lack of money, trade, banks, art, or anything else that might keep all the non-existent people of the universe occupied. However, it is not worth embarking on a long discussion of it now, because it really is terribly complicated. For further information, see Guide Chapters 7, 9, 10, 11, 14, 16, 17, 19, 21 to 84 inclusive, and in fact, most of the rest of the guide. Chapter 20. The restaurant continued existing, but everything else had stopped. Temporal relastatics held it and protected it in a nothingness that wasn't merely a vacuum, it was simply nothing. There was nothing in which a vacuum could be said to exist. The force-shielded dome had once again been rendered opaque. The party was over. The diners were leaving. Zarquan had vanished along with the rest of the universe. The time turbines were preparing to pull the restaurant back across the brink of time in readiness for the lunch sitting. And Max Quadlepleen was back in his small, curtained dressing room, trying to raise his agent on the tempophone. In the car park stood the black ship, closed and silent. Into the car park came the late Mr. Hot Black Desiato, propelled along the moving catwalk by his bodyguard. They descended one of the tubes. As they approached the limo ship, a hatchway swung down from its side, engaged the wheels of the wheelchair, and drew it inside. The bodyguard followed, and having seen his boss safely connected up to his death support system, moved up to the small cockpit. Here he operated the remote control system, which activated the autopilot in the black ship lying next to the limo, thus causing great relief to Zaphod Beeblebrox, who had been trying to start the thing for over 10 minutes. The black ship glided smoothly forward out of its bay, turned, and moved down the central causeway swiftly and quietly. At the end, it accelerated rapidly, flung itself into the temporal launch chamber, and began the long journey back into the distant past. The Milliways lunch menu quotes, by permission, a passage from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. The passage is this: "The history of every major galactic civilization tends to pass through three distinct and recognizable phases, those of survival, inquiry, and sophistication, otherwise known as the how, why, and where phases. For instance, the first phase is characterized by the question, how can we eat? The second by the question, why do we eat? And the third by the question, where shall we have lunch? The menu goes on to suggest that Milliways, the restaurant at the end of the universe, would be a very agreeable and sophisticated answer to that third question. What it doesn't go on to say is that though it'll usually take a large civilization many thousands of years to pass through the how, why, and where phases, small social groupings under stressful conditions can pass through them with extreme rapidity. How are we doing? Said Arthur Dent. Badly, said Ford Prefect. Where are we going? Said Trillian. I don't know, said Zaphod Beeblebrox. Why not? Demanded Arthur Dent. Shut up, suggested Zaphod Beeblebrox and Ford Prefect. Basically what you're trying to say, said Arthur Dent, ignoring the suggestion, is that we're out of control. The ship was rocking and swaying sickeningly as Ford and Zaphod tried to wrest control from the autopilot. The engines howled and whined like tired children in a supermarket. It's the wild colour screen that freaks me, said Zaphod, whose love affair with the ship had lasted almost 3 minutes into the flight. Every time you try to operate one of these weird black controls that are labelled in black on a black background, a little black light lights up black to let you know you've done it. I mean, what is this, some kind of galactic hyperhearse? The walls of the swaying cabin were also black. The ceiling was black. The seats, which were rudimentary since the only important trip this ship was designed for was supposed to be unmanned, were black. The control panel was black. The instruments were black, the little screws that held them in place were black, the thin tufted nylon floor covering was black, and when they lifted up a corner of it, they discovered that the foam underlay was also black.
Perhaps whoever designed it had eyes that responded to different wavelengths of a trillion. Or didn't have much imagination, muttered Arthur.
Perhaps,
said Marvin.
He was feeling very depressed.
In fact, though they didn't know it, the decor had been chosen in honour of its owner's sad, lamented, and tax-deductible condition. The ship gave a particularly sickening lurch. Take it easy, pleaded Arthur. Well, you're making me space-sick. Time-sick, said Ford. We're plummeting backwards through time. Thank you, said Arthur. Now I think I really am going to be ill. Ah, oh, go ahead, said Zaphod. We could do a little colour about the place. This is meant to be polite after-dinner conversation, is it? Snapped Arthur. Zaphod left the controls to Ford to figure out, and lurched over to Arthur. Look, Earthman, he said angrily, you've got a job to do, right? The questions are the element answer, right? What, that thing? Said Arthur. I thought we'd forgotten about that. Not me, baby. Like the mice said, it's worth a lot of money in the right quarters, and it's all locked up in that head thing of yours. Yes, but nothing. You think about it. The meaning of life. We get our fingers on that. We can hold every shrink in the galaxy up to ransom, and that's worth a bundle. I owe mine a mint. Arthur took a deep breath without much enthusiasm. All right, he said, but where do we start? I mean, how should I know? They say the ultimate answer or whatever is 42. How am I supposed to know what the question is? It could be anything. I mean, what's 6 times 7? Zaphod looked at him hard for a moment. Then his eyes blazed with excitement. 42, he cried. Arthur wiped his palm across his forehead. Yes, he said patiently, I know that. Zaphod's faces fell. I'm just saying the question could be anything at all, said Arthur, and I don't see how I'm meant to know. Because, hissed Zaphod, you were there when your planet did the big firework. We have a thing on Earth, began Arthur. Had, corrected Zaphod, called tact. Oh, never mind. Look, I just don't know. A low voice echoed dully round the cabin.
I know, said Marvin.
Ford called out from the controls he was still fighting a losing battle with. Stay out of this, Marvin, he said. This is organism talk.
It's printed in the Earthman's brainwave patterns, continued Marvin. But I don't suppose you'll be very interested in knowing that.
You mean, said Arthur, you mean you can see into my mind?
Yes,
said Marvin. Arthur stared in astonishment. And, he said,
it amazes me how you manage to live in anything that small.
Ah, said Arthur, abuse.
Yes,
confirmed Marvin. Ah, ignore him, said Zaphod, he's only making it up.
Making it up, said Marvin, swivelling his head in a parody of astonishment. Why should I want to make anything up? Life's bad enough as it is without wanting to invent any more of it.
Marvin, said Trillian, in the gentle, kindly voice that only she was still capable of assuming in talking to this misbegotten creature, if you knew all along, then why didn't you tell us? Marvin's head swiveled back to her.
You didn't ask, he said simply.
Well, we're asking you now, metal man, said Ford, turning round to look at him. At that moment, the ship suddenly stopped rocking and swaying. The engine pitch settled down to a gentle hum. Hey, Ford, said Zaphod. That sounds good. Have you worked out the controls on this boat? No, said Ford. I just stopped fiddling with them. I reckon we've just got to go wherever this ship is going and get off it fast. Yeah, right, said Zaphod.
I could tell you weren't really interested, murmured Marvin to himself,
and slumped into a corner and switched himself off. Trouble is, said Ford, that the one instrument in this whole ship that's giving any reading is worrying me. If it's what I think it is, and it's saying what I think it's saying, then we've already gone too far back into the past, maybe as much as 2 million years before our own time. Zaphod shrugged. Time is bunk, he said. I wonder who this ship belongs to, anyway, said Arthur. Me, said Zaphod. No, I mean, who it really belongs to. No, really me, insisted Zaphod. Look, property is theft, right? Therefore theft is property, therefore the ship is mine, okay? Tell the ship that, said Arthur. Zaphod strode over to the console. Ship, he said, banging on the panels. This is your new owner speaking to... He got no further. Several things happened at once. The ship dropped out of time travel mode and re-emerged into real space. All the controls on the console, which had been shut down for the time trip, now lit up. A large vision screen above the console winked into life, revealing a wide starscape and a single, very large sun dead ahead of them. None of these things, however, was responsible for the fact that Zaphod was at the same moment hurled bodily backwards against the rear of the cabin, as were all the others. They were hurled back by a single thunderous clap of noise that thudded out of the monitor speakers surrounding the vision screen.